From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. In 2006, Seattleite Jordan Hansen and three crew members rowed from New York Harbor to England. That expedition took over 2 months. Hansen and a crew tried crossing the Atlantic this year also from Dakar, Senegal to Miami. They were pretty close to the finish when their rowboat got swamped and they had to abort that mission. He joins us today to talk about those adventures.
Land ho!
Jordan Hansen writes about that successful expedition in Rowing Into the Sun, S-O-N, and we'll get into that. Four young men crossing the North Atlantic. Thank you so much for stopping by again.
Ross, thanks for having me.
This is kind of an amazing trip to take. What led up to wanting to row across the Atlantic Ocean back in 2006? You just don't go out and do that on a whim.
I think what happened was I learned how to row in college and absolutely fell in love with it. After college, I wanted to see how far I could take it, and I was rowing out of Lake Washington Rowing Club and saw a poster advertising a rowing race across the ocean, and I couldn't get it out of my mind.
Well, it's one thing rowing the Motlake Cut, and you were going across the North Atlantic. This is obviously an exponentially more difficult thing. You didn't go into it thinking it was going to be just the same, just more rolling ocean, did you?
No, not at all. I mean, I think we definitely the first person I asked, my friend Greg and teammate, he said no.
He wouldn't do it.
Well, eventually he said yes. And then the second guy, he ended up saying yes. I went back to Greg. He agreed. And then we got a fourth. And we'd all rowed at college at the University of Puget Sound.
Yeah.
And it just kind of built momentum from there. We all moved into the same house over in Wallingford. And the next 18 months, we prepared basically going out to taking this idea that we had gotten really passionate about and finding people who were experts in their field to figure out how are we going to take this passion and put it into a successful expedition.
And, of course, the boat is crucial. You had to design your own boat. How did you figure out what you were going to row across the Atlantic Ocean?
The boat was built in England, and we scraped together as much money as we could ourselves. And we brought the boat over here from England. It had just the most basic equipment on it. So we basically put it together using all the resources we had here in Seattle in the Northwest.
Tell us about the North Atlantic. What is that to traverse?
So our route was from New York to Falmouth, England, and that was roughly 3,200 nautical miles. We left on June 10th. It took us till August 20th. In the North Atlantic, especially after comparing the North Atlantic to the Mid-Atlantic, it's a little bit more volatile. The weather there isn't as consistent. It changes a little bit quicker. It's beautiful. It's such a fascinating stark landscape. You have these same ingredients, but every 2 hours they change. So you get your water, your clouds, your wind, and you row for a little bit. And at the end of your shift, if it's an hour, 2 hours, or 4 hours, it's a little bit different. When you wake up, you just feel like you're in a different space, even though you're still in the middle of the ocean. And aspects of it look the same.
How were the shifts? How long did you row? How long did you stop? Did you actually get to sleep an evening, 8 hours?
No. Yeah. So we rowed, the first trip we rowed two on, two off. And that was a pretty brutal sleep schedule. And when we were on sea anchor, all four of us hop in the back of the boat.
Explain what sea anchor is.
Sea anchor is basically a large parachute that is attached to the bow of the boat via about a 200-foot line. And it holds the bow of the boat into the waves. And so that just keeps you in one position relatively.
So that's a bit of a break. No one has to row while that's happening.
It is, but it's kind of miserable at the same time.
Oh, why is that?
Well, especially on the first trip, we found out we didn't have enough food on day 17.
Well, so. And this is day 17. Oops. First of all, how do you get to day 17 and all of a sudden realize you don't have food? How did that happen?
Well, I think when I explain this to people, you know, I compare it to a camping trip. Like if you're in charge of the food for maybe like four or five people over a weekend, that's a way bigger job than you think it's going to be. And so when you add in the fact of, well, we're going to be doing this in the middle of the ocean, this food has to last for months, and we're, you know, providing food for four people that are working out for 12 hours a day. It's an absolutely huge challenge.
Sure.
And, As team captain, I put my friend Brad in charge of it, and that's the sort of thing where I look back, and that was not a one-person job. That was something that
someone else should have been working on.
We should have had at least two people, and we should have had double the budget for it, and we should have doubled the time that we worked on.
So some people might have said, well, forget about it. We don't have enough food. we're working really hard every day. We got to kind of – did that, was there a passing thought that this is a deal killer?
We knew that it could be a trip killer, but there's – I mean, we're out there in the middle of the ocean, and we did have enough food to make it for 55 days. We just had to stretch that to 72. And so we just started rationing from day 17 on.
And you write about how you would just start talking about food. And that must have been really pleasing to have your fellow people on the boat hearing you talking about food while you're on these kind of low rations.
Yeah, well, there's two types of people. There's people that deal with food by talking about it and people who just don't talk about it at all. And so I talk about it, and I was rowing across the ocean with three people who didn't react like that.
I mean, I can't imagine – this is a pretty small boat. How long is it? How much personal space do you have?
It's 29 feet long, 6 feet wide. There's really no personal space on that boat. The cabin is 8 by 5 feet.
Yeah.
And the most personal time you're going to get is when someone's maybe making a meal outside and you ask for just some time in the cabin.
And then just practicalities – where do you go to the bathroom? You just go over the side?
No, actually, hanging it all out over the side is kind of dangerous. So we do it in a bucket and then dump it.
Mm-hmm. And that closeness for such a long period of time, hungry, kind of exhausted, how did you guys get along?
Coming from the same rowing program, I think we all had the same mentality. And as long as everybody is on the same page and everybody's working towards that goal, it's, I mean, definitely... You know, instead of getting – there was really not a whole lot of room for blowing up. You can't really yell at people on a 29-foot boat. Everybody can hear you. So there's just a lot of intense discussions, and usually it never even got to that point because it's pretty obvious what you need to do. And so we would continue talking about it until it's – I mean, until you just talk the issue to death, and usually everybody would be on the same page after that, and things would keep moving pretty smoothly.
What was the low point of this 2006 trip? 2 months across the North Atlantic, and what was the high point?
Well, I think there were several low points and several high points. I think the first one was, of course, realizing that we didn't have enough food. And then once we really hit the middle of the trip, to get to the halfway point took about 26 to 27 days. And then the rest of that trip basically took twice as long. And so from the halfway point, just things got slower and slower and slower. And there wasn't any, I think, one time where we were all feeling that low. And I think that's kind of the beauty of rowing across in as a team, because especially towards the end, it felt like there were all four of us on a balance beam and one person was always falling off. And then those three guys reach down, pull them up, and one person would fall down again. And that just – we basically balanced that up until the end.
Was there any support boat or anything – within some hours' distance that could have rescued you guys had something gone seriously wrong in the middle of the Atlantic?
There was the whole thing was a race. I mean, racing against three teams from England. And so the race organizer had a boat out there. It was a 55-foot sailboat. And they checked in on us twice. But when we hit Tropical Storm Alberto, which was the first tropical storm of the season, they got hammered way worse than we did. And so
the sailboat. Tracking, yeah.
And so about two-thirds of the way across, they had to go in early.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, if something really bad happened, we would, you know, hit our emergency transmitter, and then the closest ship would respond to us.
You mentioned how beautiful the ocean was and how it would change radically. And, of course, sailing into Falmouth must have been a high.
It was amazing. You know, I think one of the most profound things is how land smells. When you spent months and months at sea and you start hearing, when you get close enough to land that you can hear dogs barking, you can smell like the hearth, you can smell just that green pastures. That's probably one of the most profound things.
I think you've been asked this before, but you're out there, you don't have enough food. Why didn't you fish?
Well, so we had planned on bringing fishing equipment, and the 18 months leading up to this, it was the first time any of us had done anything like this. We were pretty much just out of college. And so organizing a trip like this, we had the fishing equipment. It was on the dock. And for whatever reason, it didn't make it on the boat. And no one really knows why. I mean, if we had known what that was, of course we would have put it on the boat. But we went fishing the second time around, and we had a lot of fishing equipment. And we didn't – I mean, granted, we had enough food, so we weren't as focused. But we also
– got skunked.
Yeah, totally.
Happens to all fishermen.
Yeah.
Jordan Hansen is my guest. We're talking about the two trips he took rowing across the Atlantic Ocean, the successful one in 2006, the one this year that didn't end quite at the goal. And I want to talk about this second trip. We've spoken briefly about it just after it finished. But I'm kind of curious about how did you know that with the currents and the winds they are on the open ocean that two or four rowers would just have enough power to go through that and not all of a sudden be left at the whim of what the currents were doing, what the wind was doing?
No, I think most of the time we're at the mercy of wind and current. When you're going from New York to England, you're taking into account the Gulf Stream and the predominant direction that the weather's taking you.
So you're using that for to your advantage.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it would be much harder to go the other direction.
But you did go the other
direction. Well, the other direction, but at a different part of the ocean.
Okay. And so this was the second one, and you departed from Senegal and Africa, and your goal was Miami.
Yeah.
So you were also working with the wind and currents on that part of the trip.
And that one we were expecting to work with the trade winds, and that was just a lot more we thought it would be a little bit more consistent.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people went, rowed across the Atlantic, check. But why'd you want to do it again?
Because it's beautiful out there. There's something that I find just profoundly satisfying about pulling myself across the ocean. I saw the boat got stampeded with dolphins in 2006.
What's that mean, stampeded with dolphins?
Yeah, it was this incredibly calm day. Very, very hot. I turn around because I heard something. Just very, very flat, and on the horizon, I just see white water all the way across the horizon, and it's something that I never even imagined. I just couldn't put it in my head what it was until it got closer and closer. Everybody came out on deck, and then as they got close enough to figure out what it was, you realize that it's thousands of dolphins.
Headed your way.
And there's, you know, just the amount of wildlife you see out there is absolutely fascinating. So just for the chance to do that again, was something that I just something that really called me out there again, but I think that it's a really good point because in terms of I've already rowed across the ocean once, why do it again? That was something. I mean, this second project took 4 years to plan, and for the first 2 years we were planning on doing another race, and that just was something that just didn't really ring true to myself or the new crew. Adam Creek, who's a Canadian gold medalist, I'd met him about 4 years ago and we talked about this idea. And as we were planning it, the idea of racing just was something that fell flat.
Yeah.
And as I was writing the book, one thing that I realized is that, you know, by rowing across the ocean, I had learned an incredible amount. And
you could put it to work the second time.
Well, I could put it to work, but more importantly, if we gave ourselves the tools and we had the right kind of plan, we could use this as a teaching tool.
Was it the same three crew? It wasn't the same three crew members as you had the first time.
Three different crew members.
Completely different crew members. So tell us a little bit about what you learned from the first trip that you were able to apply to the second trip. And did it work out the way you until the end? Did it work out the way you had hoped it would? Was it a lot smoother than the first time?
It went – because not only did everything work from that first trip, but –
You brought enough food this time.
Yeah, we brought enough food. Unfortunately, you know, we didn't break any oars on the first trip, but the second trip we built our riggers a little bit stronger, and so we ended up breaking two oars. But we had enough spares, and so we were able to deal with that. But it was all the extras that we were doing out there that made this trip that much more challenging because we had $40,000 worth of science gear, and we were working with the University of Washington and a ton of other scientists to test water quality as we were going along. Using our a satellite system, we were able to send all of that data back. In addition to that, we used that data and working with an organization called Adventure Learning App, we were able to basically put together lesson plans. And our main sponsor for this was the Canadian Wildlife Federation.
Mm-hmm.
And using all their resources and everything that we brought to the table, we were basically able to keep this education program going throughout the trip, as well as all this data collection that we were doing.
And who were the students who were focusing on your trip? Who were they?
We were able to get 70 classrooms, and one of them was one local classroom was King's School, but there were classrooms in Canada, across the U.S., New Zealand, and even in Senegal.
Were you able to talk to them? Did you have electronic communication?
We had electronic communication.
Wow, so you're out there rowing across the ocean, and you're talking to these classrooms.
We talked to the classrooms. We were sending them picture, audio, video. And this was something that, you know, even when we flipped 73 days into it, our education program continued to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, that was really I think if the second trip had been all about going from point A to point B, then yeah, I think that you could look at it and say, well, that wasn't quite the success they were looking for. Yeah. But we had a lot of other goals associated with this. I mean, the whole goal was to go out there and, you know, have this adventure, but to bring a message of conservation, with the Canadian Wildlife Federation using education and science.
So you had this whole other purpose to the second trip, and you were fulfilling it and doing other things. You were better prepared for it. And then you were just like 200 miles from the finish?
Not quite. We were 73% done, which we had about, I think, 900 miles to go. Mm-hmm. We were about 375 miles north of Puerto Rico. And on the 73rd day, in the middle of a shift change, which was, you know, the shift change is our most vulnerable point during the day, which happens several times a day to switch the rowers out from sleeping to rowing, we had really perfect conditions. We had about 2 meter seas that were blowing us right towards Miami. And I mean, after 73 days out there, it was, we didn't have as favorable weather as we were expecting. So yeah, having wind behind us was just a great thing.
Maybe you let your guard down a little bit because things were going so well.
No.
No?
No. Everything had really locked into place. Mm-hmm. We were surfing down these waves, and these two exceptionally steep waves came about 30 degrees off our stern. I turned the stern towards that, which is what you're supposed to do. And instead of, you know, when a wave usually hits the boat, it'll lift up the stern and slide through and you'll surf a little bit. These two waves, because they were so flat and boxy, they just overwhelmed the boat. So they just rolled over it. The first wave basically sunk the boat down. And then that second wave pushed the bow of the boat into the back of that second wave.
What a disappointing ending. Are you going to try it again?
Yeah, absolutely.
When are you going to do it again?
Right now there's a lot of wrapping up that we have to do. And even if we had made to Miami, I mean, there's still, you know, once you get back on shore, I mean, we have to tell the story. And ended up on this trip, we have really a lot more to tell than we even expected. Mm-hmm. But we're planning a trip. OrNorthwest is planning a trip around the human-powered circumnavigation and possibly some smaller trips down the Mississippi.
Hey, Jordan Hansen, thank you so much for telling us about your trips. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ray. Thanks for having me.
And the book called Rowing Into the Sun, Four Young Men Crossing the North Atlantic. It's about that first successful trip in 2006. We'll look forward to the next book about the mission which just took place. David High produces our show with Arwen Nix, along with production help from Hannah Byrne and Andy Hurst, Amber Cortez. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. I'm Ross Reynolds. Thanks for listening.